Tax Station Number 29556, Mr. Brian Haskell Thomas, Reel 5. Now, one thing we'd forgotten was twofold. You were diving officer, and you did a diver course. Now, let's look at the course first and your role as diver officer.
Well, every small ship had to have a diver and a diving officer. And the diving officer is always the warrant officer gunner, traditionally. And therefore, I was sent on the course. And this was...
Now, when did you do that course? Was that a suit when you joined the ship, or was it when you...
Oh, no, before I joined the ship.
Before you joined the ship, yeah.
Down there somewhere.
Now, this is at HMS Vernon.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we've got some new timing, so I've put it into the catalogue. You actually joined the Navy in November 41.
And yeah.
We're at Collingwood, November 41 to January 42.
Yeah.
Gunnery course, January 42 to March 42. HMS Collingwood... about April 42 to July 43.
Yeah.
King Alfred, August to September, it looks like.
Yeah.
Gunner's course, October 43.
And the diving course.
And then the diving course, November 43.
Mm.
And then HMS Magpie, you joined on the 21st of December 1943. That brings our dates up to present, but they're also incorporated in the cataloguing. Now, tell me about the diving course at HMS Vernon. What do you remember of it?
We were using the heavy helmet equipment for the first part of the course. And we had to learn the signals to make to the people pumping the air into you above by a series of tugs on a rope, which one of the chaps up on the quay held. So many for too much air, so many for not enough air, and something for pull me up quick. And at that time, they just started doing to... setting up a system whereby they could speak to the diver on the telephone. And the lady who was the Queen Mother was visiting the establishment that day, and the instructor, stupidly in my mind, said to the Queen, as she was then, "Would you like to speak to the diver, Your Majesty?" "Oh, yes, please." So she gets on the phone to, "This is the diver speaking." She got a stream of rhetoric from this chap who thought it was one of his sailors playing a trick. So she said, "I think you'd better have this." And then we got on to the lightweight suits, which were a boon. Because,
well, they're much easier.
Much easier, yes. They still had air pumped in, because we didn't have the barrels of air and oxygen that came along later. And it was important, because you get a piece of wire around your propeller. In some lonely place, you'd have to put the diver over the side to get it off. You don't call for help. And this is really why the ships were basically self-sustaining, all they did.
So both the diver and the diving officer had to be able to do the job?
Absolutely, yes. Normally I would be the controller up the top and he would go down and do the work. But occasionally I did it myself.
And now... we've looked at the sort of routine on board, you know, some of the routine,
yes.
Anyway, and we're going to pick up other things as we go along. Now, we're now into events, in a sense.
Indeed.
So what do you remember about your first few months aboard the ship? What comes most to your mind?
Well, the ship, the five ships had been across the North Atlantic in November and December and been seriously battered by the weather to the extent they had to be repaired. The Admiral Horton in Liverpool was not convinced they had to be repaired. So Captain Walker, who was the boss of the group, invited him on board and it showed him under the quarter deck, where the officers' cabins were, cracks in the what we call the deck head, you call the ceiling. "Oh, you can fill those up, all right, no problem." And Walker stamped his foot on the deck and five fire hoses were turned on the deck above and the Admiral got soaked. "You've made your point." And we needed people like Walker to innovate and make sure everything worked.
Now, what's the what's the first event you want to talk about? I mean, do you remember any particular submarine
On the 31st of January 1944, we fueled from a Shell tanker. I didn't know then I was going to work for Shell, but there we are. And then went off on a foray through in the North Atlantic, sinking U-boats. And we sunk six in 20 days on that occasion.
Now, what do you remember of that? What, give us as much as you remember of the whole tour, you know, in that January.
Well, the way the operation was set up, we had five ships steaming in line abreast, a mile apart. And the drill was, whichever ship detected the U-boat immediately hoisted a black flag. The one nearest to that ship and the ship itself hunted the U-boat, while the other three went in a circle around to stop him getting out. And of course we were at action stations all this time while there was a contact with the U-boat, and we were wary of this new gadget the Germans had produced, a torpedo which they didn't need to aim. It was just attracted by the noise of the propellers.
The acoustic torpedo.
Acoustic torpedo, yes. And the drill was, if you detected a U-boat, you immediately dropped a depth charge set to 50 feet in case it had fired one. Set it off. You used to ruin the wardroom china, but we had to do it. And then...
Do you remember any of the six submarines individually? I mean, was Magpie, how much involved was Magpie in the sink, or was it all just teamwork?
Two ships used to sink the U-boat, attack the U-boat, and Magpie and Starling sunk two of them, and the other three were sunk by Starling and one or two of the other ships.
Starling was...
The Captain Walker's ship.
And what do you remember the two you were involved with? Did you see it happen? What did you see?
Normally you don't see anything until debris comes to the surface. In that case, you had to lower a boat with a doctor in it to pick up things that would confirm we had sunk it. The Germans sometimes fired a torpedo full of debris to fool us, but... one of the key things to find human remains. That's why the doctor was in the boat. And the last one that we sunk surfaced before it went down, and we took the whole crew off, including a cameraman. And our ships had been filming the battle, and so had they. And so we've combined his film and ours into quite a telling document. And they came to our reunions after the war.
You mentioned that before. Mm. Anything else about that tour? Where were you patrolling during this?
In the South Atlantic, in the North Atlantic, a little way off the coast of Ireland. The U-boats were...
So in the Western Approaches?
Yeah, Western Approaches. The U-boats were congregating there to say can interfere with the convoys coming in.
So, I mean, how did you feel about after the end of such a successful tour?
Quite good, because there were 3,000 wrens on the jetty when we came in Gladstone Dock, Liverpool. But before that, we had lost one of our ships on the way back, had its stern blown off, HMS Woodpecker, by an acoustic torpedo. But we got the whole of that crew off, including some of the German sailors who were in their ship, the rescued sailors. And they all got back.
What were the crew like? I mean, did you have any? Were there any aboard the Magpie?
We did. We had the captain of the U-boat on the aboard the captain. In fact, we had put our German U-boat survivors in the stoker's mess deck with a sailor on guard with a revolver. I went down an hour later. He was sitting with three of these Germans, revolver on the table behind, playing cards. They'd all had second degrees in English universities, and the camaraderie of the sea is something a lot of people don't understand.
Now, anything else? So that was that patrol, very successful.
Yes, and then the next day we had some lorries arrive alongside the jetty delivering tropical kit. We said, we're going to Russia, and we were. That's because in those days any propaganda we put out was false, because Liverpool was full of Americans who were originally German, who were sympathising with the Nazi regime. They'd come in on merchant ships and then jump off and go into hiding and try and get information to send back to Germany. So anything we did or said was absolutely incorrect. And it worked. Not like this Iraq war, where they say, we're coming to get you in 2 weeks. I cannot believe the mess they made of it.
Now, so what about this Russian convoy? What do you when was that? February?
We had to get round from the west of the British Isles over to the other side, and we were delayed because one piece of equipment wasn't fully repaired, and so we went hurriedly up the west coast of Scotland and took the ship through the Kyle of Loch Ouse to cut off 50 or 60 miles. That was quite exhilarating. So narrow, because the ship was, and the ship's only 38 feet wide. We used the echo sounder to navigate with, rather than anything else. And then we got round to Scapa Flow, and all the five ships went in together, playing their signature tune, Hunting We Will Go. And of course, everybody was dressed up in whatever clothes they felt they could put on. This is known as seagoing clothing. You didn't wear a uniform at sea. As soon as you were out of sight of the Admiral in the harbour, you'd put on any clothes you liked. We had one chap who was a lookout on the bridge, wear a trilby hat and a red Macintosh. But we went in with this motley look at the crew, and all the senior people in the home fleet on battleships and cruisers and so on were taken their gasp. But Walker had been given considerable amount of extra promotion in terms of his seniority, and he was quite senior. And then on the first day on our way to Murmansk, we detected the U-boat, which sank with no trouble.
Did Walker you said about it?
Yeah, well Walker said he was a right mug, didn't know what he was doing, walked straight into us.
And now, this is February, is it?
March 44.
March.
February we were sinking the six U-boats. March 44.
So was the six U-boats February, January to February?
No, all February.
Just February, right.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I've got that wrong. That's my fault. So the Arctic convoys, now do you know its number? They all had numbers.
58. RA-58. I'm pretty sure. I can look it up.
That's the way back.
I've got
aren't they J something? J.
Yeah. I've got the.
I'll check that. Now, so you sunk a U-boat, and do you remember the circumstance? He was a mug.
Yeah, he just ambling about and ran straight into us.
And who sank that one? Which
Walker.
One?
He just dashed in and said, "I'll deal with it." And we were sent particularly to that Russian convoy because the Americans were giving the Russian a cruiser, which they were desperate to make sure it got there and didn't get sunk. So we, as the premier U-boat killing group in any navy, were sent to add to the other ships protecting the convoy.
Now, what were conditions like? I mean, because you've been in the Western Approaches,
yeah.
Which is not pleasant in February.
No.
But on the other hand, it's a good deal colder.
It was very cold. I mean, you didn't put your bare hand on any metal because you'd leave the skin off when you took it. But this was a March, so it wasn't quite so cold as it would otherwise have been. There was an enormous amount of fog most of the time, which didn't help. But we did spot one U-boat on the surface after we sunk that first one. And Walker said, "Open fire." So Captain said, "Open fire? Yeah, fire." So we fired a four-inch shell ahead of its line of advance. You could see the demeanour of the chap on the Conitar changed dramatically when he looked round. And he got sunk as well. But that's what we were there for.
And did you sank it? Your ship sank it?
Not mine, no. Well, the group sank it.
It was a group method. Group work.
We all had various goes, depending how clever the U-boat captain was. And then we got into Murmansk.
Anything else happened on the way? Were you attacked by U-boats or
they tried. Effectively? They tried, but we beat them off. We saw the odd aircraft, but not much. And then we got into Murmansk and we entertained the Russian sailors from the base. And one of the sailors on one of the ships was only about 17, an avid communist. His dad had been on the Jarrow March, never worked. And we missed him. And we went up on deck and There he was. We put a rubber dinghy down to inspect the ship's hull being damaged by ice. He was sitting in this dinghy, paddling like hell for the shore, shouting, "Hold on, comrades, I'm coming to join you." But he forgot to let go of the rope that secured it to the ship. You can sympathise with him. Hold him back. And
was he punished?
Calmed him down. No, no. Well, the captain said, "I'll give you a week's leave stoppage." Well, you couldn't get leave in my mask in any case. There was an element of sympathy in the discipline.
Anything else when you were at Murmansk?
Well, we were 50 miles from where the Germans and the Russians were fighting, and there were these babushka ladies on the beach being shown how to fire machine guns and rifles. And we did ask for some fresh vegetables, and they thought that we had heard a rumour we'd landed in France, so they brought us some cabbage. And the next day they discovered we hadn't landed in France, so they came and said, "Can we have our cabbage back?" Literally, because they were as short as food as anybody. And then we went back to Liverpool. No incidents on the way back. And the group was broken up to allow some of the ships which had been selected for duty on D-Day to prepare for their tasks. One of the things we did was repeatedly escort clapped out steamers from Plymouth round to the Thames estuary to try and convey to the Germans that really were going to land in Normandy. And then, of course...
Do you mean Normandy? Do you mean Calais?
I mean Calais, yes. I beg your pardon.
So how did that work? I mean, so you were just escorting trips around the country?
Yeah.
Were you attacked?
No. Making sure that the air force had pretty good superiority over anything that flew then. And we made sure we made a lot of black smoke so they could see what was going on. They assumed that it was going for the build-up to get on the beaches at Calais. And then we were allocated our task. There was an enormous book which was delivered to us 6 hours before we sailed, Operation Overlord. And Operation Neptune. It was the most meticulous plan I have ever seen. No matter what happened to any ship, they immediately had a solution to fill the gap, which might have been caused by it being blown up or whatever.
Now, were you briefed at all, or was it just you were issued with these orders?
No, we just issued the Operation Neptune. We were all hiding in the Solent, behind the Isle of Wight, the fleet.
Now, so what happens next then? Take me through D-Day, your D-Day operations, as you remember them.
We started off on the 6th. We started off on the 4th, but had to come back because the weather was bad. Then we started off again the next day, and we were escorting a group of landing craft. And the instructions were, under no circumstances should you stop, no matter what the reason, because this is a long supply chain of troops and material, and if people are stopping, you foul the thing up. And unfortunately, our group went faster than we'd agreed, and so we swanned about off the landing beach for about 20 minutes till the rest of the fleet caught up. Then our guys went ashore.
What were you doing when you got there?
Well, we were at action stations throughout the period.
We
just escorted them to a certain point and then turned around to get the next lot.
Now, you weren't firing then as part of the support?
No. No, the battleships fired over the cruisers fired over the destroyers, and the destroyers fired over us. One of the things I remember vividly were these landing craft which fired banks of rockets. Horrible sight. Just like a parallelogram of flame going up in the air. And then we went back to collect the next lot. But on the way back, we saw a body in the water. We were told not to stop, but he was very close to us, and he was still alive. The captain of the Royal Engineers, who it transpired, had stepped off his landing craft onto a mine in the water. And he had 57 pieces of shrapnel in him. By the time he got to Portsmouth, the doctor had taken them all out, given him two blood transfusions, and the chap was sitting up talking. And our doctor became known as Dr. Hines thereafter for 57 varieties of shrapnel. And then we continued doing that for a few weeks.
And anything happened during this period?
Yeah, we were about 400 yards from HMS Boadicea, a destroyer of 1918 vintage. And the only, this I think about middle of June, the only German aircraft we saw in the whole period. Dropped out of the cloud, dropped the bomb. Destroyer was sank with 13 survivors. And that was really quite a problem. So quick, nobody could have done anything.
Were you involved in helping? There weren't many survivors, as you said. Were you helping rescue?
No,
what there was?
No, we were told not to stop under any circumstances. But there were rescue boats going up and down, small tugs usually, to pick people out of the water. We did have to sail on one occasion through a number of chaps in the water, but we just couldn't stop, which is tragedy.
Anything else happened during this period?
They decided to give some of the ships a little rest. And one of the jobs we got was to escort the laying of the pipeline under the ocean, Pluto. And we liked that because we could only go out when the weather was absolutely calm. And so we painted a Walt Disney Pluto on our funnel and got a terrible rocket from the Admiralty for defacing His Majesty's property. We said, sorry, but we find humour to be a soothing balm. And then we carried on this for a while, and then we were sent back to the West Approaches in small groups to stop the U-boats getting up the channel.
Now, was the second escort group reformed, or was it?
No, it continued with smaller number of ships. They had little escort groups set up after that. We were joined with HMS Amethyst, another ship.
So you went back, in July would it be?
Yeah, on our normal task of hunting U-boats. They're particularly bad in the Irish Sea. You could sail up the Irish Sea full of debris from sunken ships.
It's in July 44 that Walker dies. Did you hear about that at the time?
Yeah, we all
How did you react to his death?
Well, we were shocked. Mind you, he hadn't looked well for some time, and he'd been at sea unceasingly since 1941. He had an earlier escort group, number 36, which was very successful in the area of the Bay of Biscay and other parts of the Atlantic. And this was a shock. And on the end of this film that I mentioned, we have his funeral on the reel. They took him out in HMS Harvester, I think it was, buried him at sea. And his wife and daughter on board. His daughter was a wren, and she's still alive, but not in all that best health. She used to drive a lorry around Liverpool at breakneck speed.
So anything happened in the Western Approaches that you recall?
Well, we had one or two near misses with the U-boats, but they seemed to be less keen to engage, even though they had this thing called the snorkel, which meant they could use their diesel engines while almost submerged.
So what's the next thing you remember?
Well, I suppose VE Day.
Well, that's a bit of a jump. Do you see what I mean? Nothing else that's sticking in your mind?
Well, we just...
Because that's from July through to...
May.
Nothing else particular, no incidents that you remember?
Not specific. I mean, we were constantly driving U-boats away.
We were escorting convoys or just
no,
patrolling?
No, just patrolling with the other sloops, mermaid.
Any new weapons or tactics coming in that you're aware of?
No.
Did you carry on using Walker's tactics?
Oh, yes. He was the definitive expert.
And anything happened to you during that period that you recall?
Well, I got my watchkeeping certificate. And it's quite a moment when you're left on the bridge of a ship with 200 people on board and you're in charge. But, you know, you just roll with the punches, as it were. You're constantly learning all the time.
Now, so...
But it was a hard slog through that winter. The weather was very bad most of the time.
What was it like when the weather was bad on a ship like that?
Well, you wrap an enormously thick towel around your neck, don't wear a hat, and hope the towel prevents the water getting into your clothes. I mean, in some of the gales that we were in, you would stand on the bridge and see waves 30 to 40 feet above your head, which is rather disconcerting.
And did the ship leak much? I mean,
because after the... in 2003, I took some of my sailors back to the shipyard that built Magpie, Thornycross, which was in Southampton then, is now in Portsmouth. And I told them we were coming and that the ships had leaked and we'd like to know what they thought. And they looked up their records. They said we had told the Admiralty these ships were not strong enough for the North Atlantic. The Admiralty said, tough, we need the ships. And I can understand that. 43 and 44.
Would the weather smash them up or?
Oh yes.
What damage would it do?
We'd have metal lockers full of ammunition welded to the deck, just taken off the ship, and a little breakwater between the A gun and the B gun that was welded to the deck, taken off, and a lot of damage down aft, particularly in the quarter deck where water, tons of water pouring down.
Once it was in there, could you get it out?
Well, we'd have pumps, yes. Get it out. Have to pump it out. This is the problem. Particularly the sailors get out of their hammock and find their ankle to knee deep in water in their mess deck. But that's one of the hazards. And, of course, a wet sailor's not a very happy being.
How did you get on with the crew yourself?
Oh, very well. Very well. Of course, 80% of the crew had never been to sea in their lives until they joined the ship. There's a big learning curve. We had three Royal Naval officers, captain, first lieutenant, and the engineer. We had a Merchant Navy officer as navigator, and all the rest of us were R&VR.
And you all got on pretty well?
Oh, yes. Except for one chap who annoyed the hell out of me by always relieving me late from my watch. I traditionally had the first dog, which is 4 to 6 p.m., and the middle, which is midnight to 4 a.m. And when you're relieved late at 4 a.m., it's annoying.